Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education. June Examination Series 2018. English as a Second Language. Extended Tier. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, centre number and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the exam. If you would like the recording to be louder or quieter, tell your teacher now. The recording will not be stopped while you are doing the exam. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the recording back on. Now you are all ready, here is the exam. Questions 1 to 4. You will hear 4 short recordings. Answer each question on the line provided. Write no more than 3 words or a number for each detail. You will hear each recording twice. Question 1. A. What do the students agree was the best part of the school trip? B. What do the students have to do when they return from the trip?
The school trip was great, wasn't it? I liked the museum more than I thought I was going to, and the guide was interesting. He didn't talk for too long.
Yeah. I wish we'd spent more time on the city walls, though. That was something special.
I think you're right. We were only there for half an hour, and it's what I'd been looking forward to most. Anyway, I guess we'll have to write an essay when we get back.
Well, Mr. Davis said we'd give presentations. That's not too bad, is it?
I suppose not. And it seems this won't be part of a history project either.
OK, that's good.
The school trip was great, wasn't it? I liked the museum more than I thought I was going to, and the guide was interesting. He didn't talk for too long.
Yeah. I wish we'd spent more time on the city walls, though. That was something special.
I think you're right. We were only there for half an hour, and it's what I'd been looking forward to most. Anyway, I guess we'll have to write an essay when we get back.
Well, Mr. Davis said we'd give presentations. That's not too bad, is it?
I suppose not. And it seems this won't be part of a history project either.
OK, that's good.
Question 2. A. What did the actor complain about when she was filming? B. Where did her favourite scene in the film take place?
I was in a historical drama that was filmed in a castle. The location was wonderful, even if it was slightly cold. I'm the sort of actor who will criticise the script and ask for changes if things could be improved, but I had no doubts about the quality of this one. The costume was incredibly uncomfortable, and I never stopped telling people about it, though there wasn't much that could be done. There were some great scenes in the film. I remember a dramatic scene that was filmed on the roof, which I really loved. The scene in the garden was one many fans appreciated, though I'm not sure why. I was in a historical drama that was filmed in a castle. The location was wonderful, even if it was slightly cold. I'm the sort of actor who will criticise the script and ask for changes if things could be improved, but I had no doubts about the quality of this one. The costume was incredibly uncomfortable, and I never stopped telling people about it, though there wasn't much that could be done. There were some great scenes in the film. I remember a dramatic scene that was filmed on the roof, which I really loved. The scene in the garden was one many fans appreciated, though I'm not sure why.
Question 3. A. What did the boy find challenging about doing the chemistry experiment? B. What did the girl break during the chemistry experiment?
Did you enjoy doing that experiment in our chemistry class this morning?
Yes, I don't know why the teacher said it would be difficult.
No, we had to be careful following her instructions correctly, but it wasn't that much of a problem in the end. It was using the equipment that was tricky.
I know what you mean. I nearly broke a thermometer. Then 5 minutes later I knocked a bowl onto the floor and it shattered into pieces.
And the test tubes are fragile too, aren't they? I'm surprised more of them don't get smashed.
Yeah, I think some students are a bit clumsy, so it's easy to break stuff.
Did you enjoy doing that experiment in our chemistry class this morning?
Yes, I don't know why the teacher said it would be difficult.
No, we had to be careful following her instructions correctly, but it wasn't that much of a problem in the end. It was using the equipment that was tricky.
I know what you mean. I nearly broke a thermometer. Then 5 minutes later I knocked a bowl onto the floor and it shattered into pieces.
And the test tubes are fragile too, aren't they? I'm surprised more of them don't get smashed.
Yeah, I think some students are a bit clumsy, so it's easy to break stuff.
Question 4. A. What did the photographer take pictures of to win his prize? B. What made it difficult for him to take the pictures?
I was awarded first prize in an international photography competition last month. Up to then, I'd usually concentrated on taking pictures of buildings, though I'm pretty good at landscapes too. So I suppose people who knew me were surprised when the photos I was successful with were of racing cars. It was quite a challenge though, mainly because of the bad light on that day. I was in a good position, and the crowd around me and all the people pushing and shoving didn't prevent me from getting some great shots and unusual angles. I was awarded first prize in an international photography competition last month. Up to then, I'd usually concentrated on taking pictures of buildings, though I'm pretty good at landscapes too. So I suppose people who knew me were surprised when the photos I was successful with were of racing cars. It was quite a challenge though, mainly because of the bad light on that day. I was in a good position, and the crowd around me and all the people pushing and shoving didn't prevent me from getting some great shots and unusual angles.
That is the end of the 4 short recordings. In a moment, you will hear question 5. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 5. You will hear a talk given by a man called John, describing his attempt to swim around the coast of Britain. Listen to the talk and complete the details below. Write 1 or 2 words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
I've always loved taking on big physical challenges, such as rowing across the Atlantic and cycling thousands of miles from one end of the country to the other. When I announced that I wanted to swim around Britain's coastline, people who know me well weren't surprised, but they still thought I was crazy. Anyway, I grew up near the east coast of South Africa, not too far from the border with Mozambique on the Indian Ocean. The sea, even in the summer, could still be quite rough, so that was valuable experience for dealing with really big waves. I received expert advice on the route and on what equipment was necessary, for example, a light at night. What particularly concerned me was if I should wear a wetsuit. Some experts believe your body gets used to cold and salty water more quickly without such protection. In the end, I made the choice to have one, and a swimming cap, which was essential. I didn't worry about the various sea creatures, even when my friends sent me photos of sharks. I knew it was unlikely I would meet any in the cold waters around Britain. I was nervous, though, about jellyfish. I knew I couldn't completely avoid them and might get stung. My support team followed me in a small boat. They didn't say much about my speed, because that was something left to me, although they helped me by telling me which direction I should take. I changed my swimming style once or twice, but again, my support team had little input on that sort of decision. Swimming was made difficult by a shoulder injury I suffered a few years earlier. I could still swim perfectly well, but not without occasional pain. One source of discomfort for swimmers can be a swollen tongue caused by taking in too much salt water, but fortunately that wasn't a problem for me. Aching muscles can be unpleasant too, but I didn't really notice that. As far as food was concerned, I had to consume large quantities of sugary snacks, but after a week I decided to take most of my food in liquid form. I also included a lot of bananas. The liquid mixture I drank contained plenty of sweet potato, which is something I particularly like, so I was happy to take that regularly to maintain my strength. I needed to cheer myself up when I had to swim at night, so I relied on music. It certainly helped me more than the encouragement from my support team, or even an extra treat like a chocolate bar. The weather had to be watched carefully. Low temperatures, cold enough to give me frostbite once, were common, and I just put up with it. But strong winds meant I couldn't finish the swim on time. I had to watch the tides too, but those are known in advance, so I only swam when the conditions were exactly right. I was so happy when I completed the swim, and the first thing I did was have a long, hot shower.
Now you will hear the talk again.
I've always loved taking on big physical challenges, such as rowing across the Atlantic and cycling thousands of miles from one end of the country to the other. When I announced that I wanted to swim around Britain's coastline, people who know me well weren't surprised, but they still thought I was crazy. Anyway, I grew up near the east coast of South Africa, not too far from the border with Mozambique on the Indian Ocean. The sea, even in the summer, could still be quite rough, so that was valuable experience for dealing with really big waves. I received expert advice on the route and on what equipment was necessary, for example, a light at night. What particularly concerned me was if I should wear a wetsuit. Some experts believe your body gets used to cold and salty water more quickly without such protection. In the end, I made the choice to have one, and a swimming cap, which was essential. I didn't worry about the various sea creatures, even when my friends sent me photos of sharks. I knew it was unlikely I would meet any in the cold waters around Britain. I was nervous, though, about jellyfish. I knew I couldn't completely avoid them and might get stung. My support team followed me in a small boat. They didn't say much about my speed, because that was something left to me, although they helped me by telling me which direction I should take. I changed my swimming style once or twice, but again, my support team had little input on that sort of decision. Swimming was made difficult by a shoulder injury I suffered a few years earlier. I could still swim perfectly well, but not without occasional pain. One source of discomfort for swimmers can be a swollen tongue caused by taking in too much salt water, but fortunately that wasn't a problem for me. Aching muscles can be unpleasant too, but I didn't really notice that. As far as food was concerned, I had to consume large quantities of sugary snacks, but after a week I decided to take most of my food in liquid form. I also included a lot of bananas. The liquid mixture I drank contained plenty of sweet potato, which is something I particularly like, so I was happy to take that regularly to maintain my strength. I needed to cheer myself up when I had to swim at night, so I relied on music. It certainly helped me more than the encouragement from my support team, or even an extra treat like a chocolate bar. The weather had to be watched carefully. Low temperatures, cold enough to give me frostbite once, were common, and I just put up with it. but strong winds meant I couldn't finish the swim on time. I had to watch the tides too, but those are known in advance, so I only swam when the conditions were exactly right. I was so happy when I completed the swim, and the first thing I did was have a long, hot shower.
That is the end of the talk. In a moment, you will hear question 6. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 6. You will hear 6 people talking about their attempts to keep fit. For each of speakers 1 to 6, choose from the list A to G which opinion each speaker expresses. Write the letter in the appropriate box. Use each letter only once. There is one extra letter which you do not need to use. You will hear the recordings twice. Speaker 1.
I took up jogging to get fit and thought it would be tough. In fact, I adapted quickly to it and to the discipline of doing it every morning before studying. Jogging is a solitary activity, you do it on your own, and I think I'd have been better off getting involved in a team sport. I was aware that perhaps I'd made my decision too quickly, despite people giving me ideas about what would be best for me. Never mind, I'm doing football now.
Speaker 2.
Recently I started playing netball, even though team sports aren't really my thing. I suffered at first, but I knew very well that it was going to be physically demanding. Everyone else seemed much fitter and faster than me when they moved around the court. After only a few training sessions, I was pleased to see that I already felt stronger and didn't get out of breath so easily. Some people there were just having fun, but I put a lot of effort into it.
Speaker 3.
I wanted to get fit and so did some research to find out what was best for me, but it was confusing. I had all sorts of suggestions from friends, but the problem was they were often talking about what they liked and not what would suit me. I started to go cycling and thought I would see some improvement in my level of fitness almost at once, which was a bit optimistic. People told me I hadn't taken up the right sport, but I don't regret it.
Speaker 4. Basically, I felt quite fit, but I wanted to do more to build up my strength. I looked online for advice, but it didn't help me much. I started going to the gym, and although my brother told me it wasn't the right choice, I disagreed. It was tiring going there twice a week, and I didn't think I'd come home and feel so exhausted. My friend felt fitter after only a few visits, and to my astonishment, was getting a lot of pleasure from it. But it took me much longer to make progress. Speaker 5.
I haven't always been that keen on taking exercise, but was persuaded to take up athletics after leaving school. I was a bit worried running long distances would be tough for someone like me, and it was. It was the high jump that amazed me because I'd never really tried it before. I had a great time doing it, and that was the last thing I thought I would feel. I've discovered I can take on a challenge. I'm not going to become a serious athlete, though.
Speaker 6.
I knew I wasn't very fit, so I agreed to go rowing with my friends every Monday. It started out as a bit of a laugh, and as expected, I found it a good way of relaxing and forgetting my problems. I didn't really try to improve. As time went on, my attitude changed radically. I got quite competitive and wanted to row more strongly than everyone else and win races against my friends. My progress was slow, but the important thing was that in the end, there was some improvement.
Now you will hear the six speakers again. Speaker 1.
I took up jogging to get fit and thought it would be tough. In fact, I adapted quickly to it and to the discipline of doing it every morning before studying. Jogging is a solitary activity. You do it on your own. And I think I'd have been better off getting involved in a team sport. I was aware that perhaps I'd made my decision too quickly, despite people giving me ideas about what would be best for me. Never mind. I'm doing football now.
Speaker 2.
Recently, I started playing netball, even though team sports aren't really my thing. I suffered at first, but I knew very well that it was going to be physically demanding. Everyone else seemed much fitter and faster than me when they moved around the court. After only a few training sessions, I was pleased to see that I already felt stronger and didn't get out of breath so easily. Some people there were just having fun, but I put a lot of effort into it.
Speaker 3.
I wanted to get fit and so did some research to find out what was best for me, but it was confusing. I had all sorts of suggestions from friends, but the problem was they were often talking about what they liked and not what would suit me. I started to go cycling and thought I would see some improvement in my level of fitness almost at once, which was a bit optimistic. People told me I hadn't taken up the right sport, but I don't regret it.
Speaker 4. Basically, I felt quite fit, but I wanted to do more to build up my strength. I looked online for advice, but it didn't help me much. I started going to the gym, and although my brother told me it wasn't the right choice, I disagreed. It was tiring going there twice a week, and I didn't think I'd come home and feel so exhausted. My friend felt fitter after only a few visits, and to my astonishment, was getting a lot of pleasure from it. But it took me much longer to make progress. Speaker 5.
I haven't always been that keen on taking exercise, but was persuaded to take up athletics after leaving school. I was a bit worried running long distances would be tough for someone like me, and it was. It was the high jump that amazed me because I'd never really tried it before. I had a great time doing it, and that was the last thing I thought I would feel. I've discovered I can take on a challenge. I'm not going to become a serious athlete, though.
Speaker 6.
I knew I wasn't very fit, so I agreed to go rowing with my friends every Monday. It started out as a bit of a laugh, and as expected, I found it a good way of relaxing and forgetting my problems. I didn't really try to improve. As time went on, my attitude changed radically. I got quite competitive and wanted to row more strongly than everyone else and win races against my friends. My progress was slow, but the important thing was that in the end, there was some improvement.
That is the end of question 6. In a moment, you will hear question 7. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 7. You will hear an interview with a songwriter called Melissa Blake. Listen to the interview and look at the questions. For each question, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C, and put a tick in the appropriate box. You will hear the interview twice.
Melissa Blake is one of the best young songwriters on the scene today, winning many awards for her songs. How did you get into songwriting?
As a child, I wasn't particularly keen on music. Both my parents were musical, and so I had opportunities to learn to sing when I was quite small. They didn't push me, but my parents were disappointed I wasn't more enthusiastic. Gradually, my attitude changed as I attended concerts and realised how songs could communicate important messages. Then I knew I wanted to focus my energies on music and on lyrics, aiming to do it professionally one day.
Do you have a special place where you do all your writing?
At one time, I used to sit in my attic and do everything there. It was away from my family, and so I had no distractions, even though I didn't have a nice armchair. I loved travelling to new places and found I could write on planes, though my concentration wasn't brilliant. Hotel rooms are suitable in the same way as my attic, because I'm quite cut off.
You've often said that you get your inspiration from reading.
For me, the link between reading and writing is clear. The best songwriters read widely, especially novels. It's not a matter of getting ideas from what happens in the stories themselves. It's about how these writers express themselves. I'm always amazed at how they use a word or a phrase to describe something in a way that I never would have thought about.
Do you revise your song lyrics a lot?
Yes, constantly. Even though I'm usually satisfied with my first version, I work quickly, but that doesn't mean I get a lot wrong the first time. When I review my work, I try to say the same thing in fewer words, and so I'm always cutting text. The first time, I just write whatever comes into my head, and I'm not thinking about the length at that stage.
Is it true that people think your happy songs are better than anything else you do?
I've written about parties and celebrations, and these songs instantly cheer someone up, though they haven't made as much money as I'd hoped. Sad songs often touch the hearts of audiences and sell very well, though I find it a challenge to make them truly original. I'm happiest when my lyrics deal successfully with a variety of complicated emotions all felt at the same time. After all, people aren't just happy or sad. However, these songs aren't always appreciated.
You're best known for your song Sunrise. What do you remember about writing it?
Lyrics often pop into my head as I play my guitar. With Sunrise, it was different. I'd spent the day in the forest near my house, revisiting memories of a holiday I'd had last summer. I went to bed really late that night and suddenly woke up from a dream after only a couple of hours. That immediately inspired me to jot down my ideas in a little book, which I always have by my side.
Do you like being interviewed about your work?
Well, it's a chance to discuss my upcoming projects, and that's always fun. I often have to point out that my songs aren't autobiographical, but I'm not sure anyone believes me, which is silly of them. I know some songwriters are also irritated when journalists or fans want to know what the songwriter's trying to say in the lyrics, but that doesn't bother me. I accept that songwriters have a duty to help people understand.
Do you sing your own songs much?
I used to when I was a band member, and so I never lacked confidence in my ability to perform. Now I'm not in a band and am more independent, even though singers often invite me to do shows with them. Now I see myself in a different role, working with different singers and helping them to be successful by giving them great songs. That's more interesting than performing live.
Melissa, thank you.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Melissa Blake is one of the best young songwriters on the scene today, winning many awards for her songs. How did you get into songwriting?
As a child, I wasn't particularly keen on music. Both my parents were musical, and so I had opportunities to learn to sing when I was quite small. They didn't push me, but my parents were disappointed I wasn't more enthusiastic. Gradually, my attitude changed as I attended concerts and realised how songs could communicate important messages. Then I knew I wanted to focus my energies on music and on lyrics, aiming to do it professionally one day.
Do you have a special place where you do all your writing?
At one time, I used to sit in my attic and do everything there. It was away from my family, and so I had no distractions, even though I didn't have a nice armchair. I loved travelling to new places and found I could write on planes, though my concentration wasn't brilliant. Hotel rooms are suitable in the same way as my attic, because I'm quite cut off.
You've often said that you get your inspiration from reading.
For me, the link between reading and writing is clear. The best songwriters read widely, especially novels. It's not a matter of getting ideas from what happens in the stories themselves. It's about how these writers express themselves. I'm always amazed at how they use a word or a phrase to describe something in a way that I never would have thought about.
Do you revise your song lyrics a lot?
Yes, constantly. Even though I'm usually satisfied with my first version, I work quickly, but that doesn't mean I get a lot wrong the first time. When I review my work, I try to say the same thing in fewer words, and so I'm always cutting text. The first time, I just write whatever comes into my head, and I'm not thinking about the length at that stage.
Is it true that people think your happy songs are better than anything else you do?
I've written about parties and celebrations, and these songs instantly cheer someone up, though they haven't made as much money as I'd hoped. Sad songs often touch the hearts of audiences and sell very well, though I find it a challenge to make them truly original. I'm happiest when my lyrics deal successfully with a variety of complicated emotions all felt at the same time. After all, people aren't just happy or sad. However, these songs aren't always appreciated.
You're best known for your song Sunrise. What do you remember about writing it?
Lyrics often pop into my head as I play my guitar. With Sunrise, it was different. I'd spent the day in the forest near my house, revisiting memories of a holiday I'd had last summer. I went to bed really late that night and suddenly woke up from a dream after only a couple of hours. That immediately inspired me to jot down my ideas in a little book, which I always have by my side.
Do you like being interviewed about your work?
Well, it's a chance to discuss my upcoming projects, and that's always fun. I often have to point out that my songs aren't autobiographical, but I'm not sure anyone believes me, which is silly of them. I know some songwriters are also irritated when journalists or fans want to know what the songwriter's trying to say in the lyrics, but that doesn't bother me. I accept that songwriters have a duty to help people understand.
Do you sing your own songs much?
I used to when I was a band member, and so I never lacked confidence in my ability to perform. Now I'm not in a band and am more independent, even though singers often invite me to do shows with them. Now I see myself in a different role, working with different singers and helping them to be successful by giving them great songs. That's more interesting than performing live.
Melissa, thank you.
That is the end of the interview. In a moment, you will hear question 8. Now look at the questions for this part of the exam. Question 8, Part A. You will hear a man giving a talk about his work as a park ranger in an important American national park. Listen to the talk and complete the sentences in Part A. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the talk twice.
My name's George Ryan, and I work as a park ranger, someone who's responsible for looking after one of America's biggest and most important national parks. The first park ever set up was Yellowstone National Park in 1872. Others include the Capitol Reef Park, which I'd love to work in one day, and the famous Rocky Mountain Park. For the majority of the time since graduation, I've worked there, alongside many other rangers, and we manage an area of 979 square kilometres, covering a wide variety of unique habitats. It's a fascinating job, and it involves a wide range of very different duties. My day begins before dawn. One of my daily tasks is to ensure the wildlife is safe, and when I can, I inspect the campsites to see whether any visitors have left litter behind, which should have been taken home. People often ask what qualifications you need to become a park ranger. Well, rangers may have degrees in natural sciences or in something more specialised, like forestry. At university, my degree was in environmental studies. Once you are a ranger, you will have to get qualifications in first aid, and although people find this hard to believe at first, they also have to do a course in customer service. This is because we have a lot of contact with the public, taking them on guided tours, for example. There are always a number of measures being implemented to improve the park. Right now, I'm repairing paths, some of which weren't in good condition. It's physically very demanding and tiring work. Last year, there was a massive project underway that involved planting trees, and we also set about erecting signs so that visitors would have more information about the park's less well-known attractions. It can be a dangerous job, but I keep cool and calm whatever situation I find myself in. Of course, people always talk about the possibility of encountering a mountain lion or stepping on a poisonous snake, both of which you can quite easily come across. But over the years, the most terrifying moment wasn't anything to do with animals. There was once a flash flood that happened very suddenly and threatened to sweep me away. I have to be prepared for the unexpected, that's for sure.
Now you will hear the talk again.
My name's George Ryan, and I work as a park ranger, someone who's responsible for looking after one of America's biggest and most important national parks. The first park ever set up was Yellowstone National Park in 1872. Others include the Capitol Reef Park, which I'd love to work in one day, and the famous Rocky Mountain Park. For the majority of the time since graduation, I've worked there, alongside many other rangers, and we manage an area of 979 square kilometres, covering a wide variety of unique habitats. It's a fascinating job, and it involves a wide range of very different duties. My day begins before dawn. One of my daily tasks is to ensure the wildlife is safe, and when I can, I inspect the campsites to see whether any visitors have left litter behind, which should have been taken home. People often ask what qualifications you need to become a park ranger. Well, rangers may have degrees in natural sciences or in something more specialised, like forestry. At university, my degree was in environmental studies. Once you are a ranger, you will have to get qualifications in first aid, and although people find this hard to believe at first, they also have to do a course in customer service. This is because we have a lot of contact with the public, taking them on guided tours, for example. There are always a number of measures being implemented to improve the park. Right now, I'm repairing paths, some of which weren't in good condition. It's physically very demanding and tiring work. Last year, there was a massive project underway that involved planting trees, and we also set about erecting signs so that visitors would have more information about the park's less well-known attractions. It can be a dangerous job, but I keep cool and calm whatever situation I find myself in. Of course, people always talk about the possibility of encountering a mountain lion or stepping on a poisonous snake, both of which you can quite easily come across. But over the years, the most terrifying moment wasn't anything to do with animals. There was once a flash flood that happened very suddenly and threatened to sweep me away. I have to be prepared for the unexpected, that's for sure.
Question 8, Part B. Now listen to a conversation between two students about a national park in America and complete the sentences in Part B. Write one or two words only in each gap. You will hear the conversation twice.
That was an interesting talk by the park ranger, wasn't it?
Yes. I've done some research on Yellowstone National Park because I've decided to make it the subject of my class presentation next week. I've been trying to decide what geological feature to talk about in detail.
That must have been difficult.
Yes. I was thinking of concentrating on the geyser called Old Faithful, which is probably the most popular tourist attraction. I also gave serious consideration to the hot springs too. The volcano there is perhaps the most striking aspect and will catch everyone's attention. It's partly under Yellowstone Lake and is thought to be still active. That's what I'll do my research on.
It's the animals in the park that really interest me. You can find large numbers of bears there, and it's one of the jobs of the rangers to make sure these creatures don't get too close to people who are camping.
Yes, and don't forget the bison. There used to be millions, but they were hunted to the brink of extinction. Numbers are recovering, and there are now about 4,000 in the park.
And can you see wolves there too?
Well, I've read that there weren't any left in the park at one time, but at the end of the last century, this species returned there after a long absence, with the assistance of conservationists.
The park gets 2 million visitors annually. That's a problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's the pollution from car exhaust fumes, for a start.
And the damage caused simply by people walking the well-established routes around the park in huge numbers, harming the surroundings.
Yes, that leads directly to erosion, which is of particular concern. The tourists could end up destroying the very thing they love so much.
The park isn't just for tourists, is it? Some hunting is permitted, but rangers watch out for people doing it illegally.
There's also some farming, mainly cattle. What I found a bit of a shock was that companies are allowed to carry out mining in the park.
You'd think that would be banned.
Anyway, there are so many other things visitors can do in the park. Hiking is obviously very popular.
But activities such as mountain climbing are out of the question because the rocks in the park are soft and fragile, so potentially dangerous. On the other hand, where the rocks are more solid, caves have been opened up for potholing.
It sounds like a great place. I'd really love to go there one day.
Now you will hear the conversation again.
That was an interesting talk by the park ranger, wasn't it?
Yes. I've done some research on Yellowstone National Park because I've decided to make it the subject of my class presentation next week. I've been trying to decide what geological feature to talk about in detail.
That must have been difficult.
Yes. I was thinking of concentrating on the geyser called Old Faithful, which is probably the most popular tourist attraction. I also gave serious consideration to the hot springs, too. The volcano there is perhaps the most striking aspect and will catch everyone's attention. It's partly under Yellowstone Lake and is thought to be still active. That's what I'll do my research on.
It's the animals in the park that really interest me. You can find large numbers of bears there, and it's one of the jobs of the rangers to make sure these creatures don't get too close to people who are camping.
Yes, and don't forget the bison. There used to be millions, but they were hunted to the brink of extinction. Numbers are recovering, and there are now about 4,000 in the park.
And can you see wolves there too?
Well, I've read that there weren't any left in the park at one time, but at the end of the last century, this species returned there after a long absence, with the assistance of conservationists.
The park gets 2 million visitors annually. That's a problem, isn't it?
Absolutely. There's the pollution from car exhaust fumes for a start.
And the damage caused simply by people walking the well-established routes around the park in huge numbers, harming the surroundings.
Yes, that leads directly to erosion, which is of particular concern. The tourists could end up destroying the very thing they love so much.
The park isn't just for tourists, is it? Some hunting is permitted, but rangers watch out for people doing it illegally.
There's also some farming, mainly cattle. What I found a bit of a shock was that companies are allowed to carry out mining in the park.
You'd think that would be banned.
Hmm. Anyway, there are so many other things visitors can do in the park. Hiking is obviously very popular.
But activities such as mountain climbing are out of the question because the rocks in the park are soft and fragile, so potentially dangerous. On the other hand, where the rocks are more solid, caves have been opened up for potholing.
It sounds like a great place. I'd really love to go there one day.
That is the end of question 8 and of the exam. In a moment, your teacher will collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, centre number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, please collect all the papers.